the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We're not exactly turning the corner in terms of demand pull. What we're really turning the corner in is this overabundance of debt with no buyers. We've got rates that are moving up because the bond prices are moving down. Yes, I do see opportunities in the gold stocks. They're poised for a turnaround. As you know, in the last 5-6 years, they've been tightening their belts, lowering their costs. This primes them for a very strong move to the upside as gold starts to accelerate.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We have some special guests today, Dave. It's about time, actually, that you bring on the team that makes the decisions for McIlvaney Wealth Management. We get so much insight from them on a weekly basis. I know Dave Burgess writes his weekly report, and of course, Doug Noland. I mean, what a team.
Well, an in-house treasure trove is how I think of them. And, you know, when I am looking for insights in a given topic, what we usually do is, as a group, hammer them out. We bring all of our ideas into a conversation and begin hashing out the details.
Well, and I think the difference between an academic, Dave, we've talked about this before, and someone who actually is being tested by the market moment by moment by moment. There's a huge difference in listening to what their opinions are over time.
But Dave Burgess started his investment career over 25 years ago with Nuveen Investments in Chicago. He was an analyst and then a portfolio manager for about 10 years, worked in the same capacity with Claymore Securities before moving to Durango and joining our company. And great to have him on the team.
Well, and all that's impressive, Dave, but I'm most impressed with the fact that he almost went to the Olympics as a swimmer, a collegiate swimmer.
No, he's a fast man in the pool, that's for sure. I mean, if ever you should see him with his shirt off, don't be surprised by the gills just under his arms right there.
Well, and then there's Doug Noland, okay, which Doug is a man that we've been reading for years. And, you know, Jim Deeds, a guest of ours often, he would call me and he'd say, Kevin, have you read Doug Noland's Credit Bubble Bulletin this week? You have to.
Well, the Credit Bubble Bulletin goes back to 1999.
Yeah.
And that overlapped his time where he helped Kurt Rischerbacher write the Rischerbacher letter. And as a credit guy, I mean, this is his area.
Yeah.
He was a credit analyst with Toyota, working with Rischerbacher the same way. Spent 9 years working in the hedge fund industry with Gordy Ringon and with Bill Fleckenstein in Seattle. And then went for a 16-year stint with Prudent Bear Funds, where he was not only portfolio manager, but ultimately senior vice president, head of alternative equities management at Federated Investors.
Well, and no offense, Dave, I hate to call you a headhunter. You probably never thought you were one, but actually you went out and headhunted this talent. And fortunately, he said yes.
I'll tell you the problem with growing a company like we have. It's finding the right people, because honestly, there are a million resumes that may read similarly, but there's only about two guys that I would say have the requisite character and fortitude, the requisite disposition to serve clients and always keep them first in what they do. And I think I'm surrounded by the best team imaginable. And we'll continue to grow that team, but again, it's going to be one person at a time, and it just doesn't happen every day. You have the quality of people as well as the skill set matched to assist clients in their financial portfolio structuring.
It seems to be a good team, a good match.
Well, 2016 was a big year for our wealth management group. Dave, starting with the announcement of a new strategy on the MWM platform, which you've been working on over the last several years. And then in addition to that, merging with an advisory in Kansas City, Deed Select Advisors, their key people moving out to Durango this year. Doug Noland, you're joining our team as a portfolio manager. So basically, we've gone from having three robust offerings to six. As often, frankly, as we have world-class guests on the program, sometimes we forget that some of the best insights and decisions are unearthed right here, right under our noses. So thank you for joining me today and sort of adding to those top-shelf conversations. Dave, you joined us 12 years ago from a mutual fund company in the Chicago area. You were with Nuveen for a long stretch. You also worked with Claymore Securities. At present, you manage four different account styles for us, one that I just mentioned. What would you say are the greatest challenges managing money in the current environment?
You know, I gave this topic a bit of thought, and I could answer the question in any number of ways. But what stands out to me, what's the most important thing, I think, is the leverage that we see in the marketplace today. The leverage is a function of those low interest rates. I think we're at a 30-35-year low in the interest rate cycle. But knowing full well at some point in time that we're going to go through a different stage in that cycle where interest rates rise, therefore raising the discount rate, so to speak, to an overvalued stock market, a stock market that's trading right now between 20 and 30 times earnings, depending on the stock that you're looking at, which is also exacerbated, of course, by the internal leverage that corporations are using, most notably today through share buybacks, which most of them, I believe, are being financed through debt offerings and other things of the like.
But, you know, raising the discount rate effectively has the impact of lowering expected returns. I don't think the average investor buying stocks today is looking for a low return environment. They're hoping quite the opposite. At least that's what the enthusiasm would have. But you're saying that there's a natural consequence to raising interest rates, which is to lower your expected returns. And that really hasn't been factored in yet. Well, Doug, you're a specialist on the short side. You know, to have a bearish inclination, that puts you in a group of about six similar people on the planet. And it's not quite extinction, but certainly bears are now on an endangered species list. And I was thinking, in fact, that perhaps we could draw some attention to our new tactical short, doing a fundraiser with the World Wildlife Federation.
Isn't that the truth?
But why do you do what you do? And what makes you so persistent?
It's true. I didn't choose the easiest career path. Most investment professionals, they cannot see a market go against them 100% because markets can't go to zero. But on the short side, it's a little different. I've seen the general stock market go up 300% three times during my career. And when you see these periods, this last one has lasted almost, 9 years, it kind of cleans out all the naysayers. It cleans out people that were short, cleans out the bears. Everyone turns bullish. So for me, those are the environments that create opportunity. And I just love the analysis. I feel like, you know, 25 years, 30 years ago, I found my niche in life. And I wake up every day, even when the markets are difficult, it's just a challenge and fascinating. I can't imagine doing anything else.
And persistence. It takes a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm probably just a strange guy when it comes to that, because kind of a small town kid from Oregon, I just love to work hard. I love independent thinking. And on the short side, it gives you a lot of freedom to think independently. I can't imagine working on the long side, especially today where you have to be bullish. I can't imagine the group dictating how I analyze and think about things. So for me personally, this is perfect.
So what is, Doug, what is the MWM tactical short and what makes it, in your opinion, a superior offering? Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Yeah, I'm really excited about our new offering. Let's go back to 1990. That was my first year on the short side. I worked for a bearish hedge fund manager out in San Francisco, Gordy Ringon. And the model back then was, you know, we analyzed companies. We knew the companies better than the longs did. We would put on concentrated positions, wait for them to work. And Gordy was phenomenally successful, a long-term track record. We were up, I think, 63% my first year in 1990. Then the market environment changed, and what we had done for years didn't work anymore. So that started for me this quest to build a better model for managing short exposure. I worked in the mutual fund industry for 16 years. I implemented a lot of changes to that old hedge fund model, do a lot of things in your portfolio to manage risk better, to have better liquidity, to reduce the overall beta of your portfolio, to change your exposure depending on the market environment. And that was very successful. Those changes, it was a better model, you know, we'll call it a better mousetrap. And now this is the latest iteration, doing some tweaks here to the old model I developed previously. In this model, a lot more flexibility to be less short if we need to be generally in this tactical strategy. And this is for separately managed accounts. These are transparent liquid accounts. We're going to short stocks, sectors. We'll short the general market. We'll short other asset classes. You know, we'll be very flexible and we want to be short where the best risk reward opportunities are. And importantly, we're going to be very disciplined with risk management and we're happy to get out of the way if the environment's very unfavorable. And we also, and this is one of the weaknesses of the previous strategy that I worked with, where it was very difficult to capture gains. If the market went down and you had gains, you were still obligated. The mandate was still to remain short the market. We're going to have more flexibility and, you know, if we're opportunistic and have some good gains, and we can really pull back our exposure and capture those gains. So it's a new product. We think it could be very successful long-term in the marketplace, and we're excited to talk more about it.
So by tactical, you're really talking about added flexibility to a mandate, which allows you to not only pursue a variety of asset classes and sectors, but also sort of the intensity of your engagement in shorting. You could be 100% short, or you could be sitting in treasury bills, not short at all. You have the flexibility that you feel you need, which is something that has been lacking in previous iterations of short offerings.
Absolutely. Flexibility to be opportunistic and to get out of the way of rapidly rising markets when necessary. So that was very important when we conceptualized this product, is we wanted a broad mandate that allows us the flexibility we think we need in very volatile, uncertain markets.
Dave, take us up to the 40,000 foot level. What are the significant shifts you see that have your attention right now? Are there any important shifts in the TIC numbers? Is it the incoming administration? Is it corporate America that has your attention, whether it's revenues or earnings? What lingers in your mind when you go home at night?
Well, that's an interesting question, Dave. I would have to say that the number one thing that concerns me at this point is the TIC data. This is the Treasury data that concerns capital flows coming in from foreign creditors. Okay. And this dates back to 1975 when we went off the gold standard officially and went on to the oil standard. From 1975 and accelerating through the 80s and 90s, we saw an increased amount of foreign interest in the dollar or securities that are behind the dollar, that being treasuries, mortgages, corporate bonds, and equities, just to name a few. The peak in foreign creditor purchases, I believe, was in 2006. And I think at that time we had about, I think it was the peak of about $160 billion a month of foreign capital coming here into the States in support of our dollar, keeping it elevated along with certain securities. Most notably, of course, is the Treasury. Now that $160 billion a month that was 2006 numbers here has been tapering off, if you will, from 2006 until today. It's been up and down over the last several years, but it's been hovering or in and around the zero mark now for, I would say, a year and a half to 2 years, pretty comfortably. So what that means to say is we have absolutely zero foreign capital net coming into the country. One of the big sellers right now is China. As you know, they have problems there in their marketplace, and they're trying to rectify issues by selling U.S. reserves to handle their problems. In any case, what this really means for the U.S. is that now we're on a new grading scale, completely new grading scale, such that if we don't have foreign creditor financing, we are forced to seek it internally. And as a debtor nation, I think we are running somewhere in the range of about $89 trillion right now, which includes the shadow banking sector, which isn't talked about very much. But if we intend on growing from here, we're obviously going to have to come up with some stimulus, right? And that stimulus is going to be very difficult to acquire or come up with without adversely affecting, let's say, the bond market in this case, without that foreign creditor support. So we're going to be on the same grading scale, I think, as other nations that we've seen, whether it's, you know, I hate to compare us to, say, Brazil or Greece or Italy or Spain, but if we're forced to search for internal sources of finance, it could be very difficult to come up with. I think it was over since 2009, we've had about $3.8 trillion worth of stimulus every year on average. That includes 2015 and 16 when the Fed wasn't printing.
So let's say that the old world issue is foreign financing. The new world issue is, as you say, new grading scale. We've got to move internal. Why don't we say that the new world is actually a brave new world and just assume that the Fed's balance sheet can be expanded? I mean, I don't know what the limits are. I think if you rolled the clock back 10 years, you would have said, we can't get to $5 trillion. And now we might say, well, you certainly couldn't see 10 or 15 or 20 trillion on the Fed balance sheet. But if it requires internal financing, why not do that? I mean, are the consequences so grave that you can't consider it? Is it ineffective? Is that what we've seen in Europe? Why not embrace the brave new world?
Well, I think the consensus view right now is the Fed can do anything, you know, that we're bulletproof under their tutelage, right? So I don't think the future is going to be without an experiment. And that experiment would entail trying to print money to save the system. We've done it before. Do it again. right? But when you're printing money and or alternatively borrowing money to stimulate your economy in tandem with other nations that are doing the same thing. Remember, way back when it was really just Japan and the United States. Japan would print, we would borrow, and it was yin and yang, and it worked. But now you have the ECB, you have China, you have the Swiss National Bank, you have Sweden, Russia. There are quite a few developed nations right now that are all printing at the same time. And the big question, of course, is who's absorbing all that liquidity, right? So it becomes incrementally more difficult as we want to add to that currency pool, as we want to add to that debt pool in order to finance our growth as we have in the past 10, 15, 20 some odd years. It's going to be more difficult to avoid the negative consequences that come with excessive amounts of borrowing and or printing. So those negative consequences, lower valuation for your currency, lower valuations for your bonds, higher interest rates. And to a debtor community, that's going to be very tough to grow in that environment because we need to borrow more money in order to grow, right? And it's going to be very difficult to do at higher rates. So I think we're in a stage right now where it's slowly developing, but at some point in time, right, the dam will break and you'll see the floodwaters and we'll start to see interest rates move up meaningfully.
Doug, as a bear, as someone who's willing to bet on declines in various markets or asset classes, what environment would be a real head turner for you, where personal assets might leave a safe haven position and move into the markets, whether that's long equities, long bonds, long anything? What's compelling to you? Can you imagine that circumstance? Paint a picture for us.
Yeah, sure. I can imagine that circumstance. You know, I'm very outspoken. I think this is, you know, a historic bubble. We're at the late stage of a bubble that's been going on really for decades. And when this bubble bursts, I would like to be opportunistic and buy things at a good price. But right now, you know, as Dave mentioned, interest rates are historically low. We've been at almost zero interest rates. Bond yields have been extraordinarily low. And you've also had this backstop bid in the market. You know, the markets believe if there's any problem, the central banks will step in to ensure there's not a bear market. Well, if we could see a different environment where prices were determined in the market, not by central banks, I would be happy to be an investor. We're a long ways from that right now, though.
So maybe with that in mind, you can simplify and shrink your investment thesis, the present tense, where you are cautious and bearish. Shrink down your investment thesis for our audience. Actually, if you would, just kind of assume you're talking to my kids. And, you know, you've got the present tense backdrop. That's important. But how do you demonstrate theoretically where we're at now and the moves that need to be made in the future as well? Is this simply a question of value?
You know, throughout history, we've had so many monetary inflations, but that doesn't mean anything to your kids, so I won't explain it in that way. But what we've done is we've created all this new money and credit. And for this example, we've created all this money. And it works well until, for whatever reason, you can't continue to create new money. And that might be inflation, or it might be a crisis of confidence in the underlying value of that money, right? You can only print so much of it before people start to question its value. I look at equities and risk assets, and I don't really look at them from a value perspective, but I definitely look at money from a value perspective. And you can't continue to have central banks and governments create all this new money and for the markets to always trust it. And that's where it'll come down to for me. I mean, at some point in the bubble, there'll be a crisis of confidence. We saw how this can work in 2008, 2009. And I fear that the next crisis of confidence will be even greater. Why? Because during this cycle over the last 8 or 9 years, we printed so much money, unlike anything in history. And I say print, these are, you know, basically just electronic debits and credits. It's just electronic entries out there. And at this point, the market believes all those entries are backed by wealth. But at the end of the day, I think they'll question, you know, that faith.
Dave, wealth management is, it's literally in your blood. You've got several generations of investing and seeking out stable value. That's what's behind you. I have to say, I think that you've learned, you've grown, you've even raised the bar from one generation to the next. I witness your daily commitment to your responsibilities, the disciplines involved, and it's an effort. it's an effort not unlike your professional swimming career. I thank you for shifting your wardrobes when you changed your career. What it requires is daily discipline. And I'm curious, what has surprised you in recent years what seems to, and you pick your choice, either evolved positively or devolved in the markets, say in the last 5 years? What's been the surprise?
Well, I'd have to say that what's evolved is the access to information, I think, is exemplary. It's great. You know, I can find information on just about any sector that's out there, analyze it thoroughly, at least from a macro perspective. So the access information is remarkable. It's just that what has devolved is that the information isn't always useful, right? We live in a world where we're printing money out of thin air, and that money is applied to the marketplace. So where there's sort of this artificial prosperity, you bring up the word discipline. I would say that we have a lack of discipline in the marketplace at this point, because who needs it when we can print money out of thin air and do whatever you want with it, right? So I can look at the data, and I'm sure Doug can attest to this, is that you can have the data sitting in front of you, and the charts will tell you that the market is ripe to do this or that if it's overvalued. And then you wake up the next morning and you realize the market doesn't care. And that's really in a world of printed money, free money. So discipline will return to the industry at some point in time, as we've been talking about. Interest rates will change, I think, and everybody will have to go back to work and really do their due diligence, credit risk per se, when it comes to analyzing a stock and or a bond or any security for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. In a period of easy money, hard work isn't necessarily rewarded.
Mm-mm.
Because the investment world becomes more casino-like. Mm-hmm. And that means that participants benefit from gambling, not necessarily thinking and analyzing risk, et cetera, et cetera. So, Doug, I'm curious, you know, we've got this idea that inflation is, I mean, at least the official statistics have turned a corner, appear to be turning up a bit. And we're also shifting from monetary policy to fiscal policy moves. We've slowed down on the monetary policy side and appear with the new administration to be ramping up on the fiscal policy side, which may suggest that there's a resurgence in inflation during the next 2 to 4 years. How does the shift in focus from deflation of the last 8-9 years to inflation over the next several, how do you anticipate that altering the current asset price landscape?
Yes, I think it's a key shift. I think 2017 is an inflection year. You can pull up inflation charts, you know, in Asia, Europe, even here in the US, and it points up now. You know, it's pointed down for a number of years. And while it was pointing down, that gave a lot of flexibility to central bankers, where they could justify, rationalize QE, saying there was very little inflation risk. So you could err on the side of printing money and inflating stock markets. I think those days are over now. I think central bankers will have to think twice before they resort to more QE. So that definitely changes the risk-reward calculus in risk assets. The rise in inflation and the higher risk in securities, I think, increases the attractiveness of gold and precious metals. So yeah, I think key changes, you know, we're starting to see it in the marketplace already this year.
Dave, I'm curious, you're on the phone quite a bit with clients, prospective clients, and once the market is closed and your portfolio management hat is off, describe a recurrent conversation with clients. What is someone who's exploring the idea of opening an account? What are they concerned with? What's on their mind right now?
Well, most people that come to us have a full portfolio of stocks and bonds. They have full ownership. They're exposed per se. And behind it, typically, there's an organization or perhaps even an individual that carries with that portfolio a certain kind of blind naivete with respect to the markets. The client, in this case, knowing something's wrong, they just have a feeling something's wrong in this environment, either from the endless streams of prosperity, with the market being up, as Doug mentioned earlier, you know, 300%, I think, what was it, 2 or 3 times over his career. They know the music is going to stop at some point in time, and they want to go with an organization or an individual that at least has some sobering viewpoint with respect to the risks inherent in the marketplace. So if I'm going to say anything at all here, it's they're looking for continuation in the ownership of America, ownership in companies, ownership in people. There's a certain amount of pride that goes along with that, but they want insurance. And if we're going to define insurance here, it's protecting something of value, right? So we could talk about insurance, but won't want to belabor the point, but we're getting into an environment where even the insurance costs quite a bit in this environment. And maybe Doug can comment on this as well, is that we're looking at natural hedges in a portfolio without the use of leverage in where we can, of course, to hedge a person's stocks and bonds in their portfolio and gives them that sense of comfort, knowing full well that the wind will shift in the marketplace and they're going to be protected from that kind of downside.
So staying close to, if you could call it market neutral, while owning high quality, that's sort of the balance that you want today.
Yes. Market neutral, I think in terms of our ownership, when you say quality, we're still looking for names that are out there that are positioned to benefit from, or at least can survive much better, relatively speaking, with other companies in times of inflation.
Speaking of inflation, you know, gold will at times, when you have a shift in inflation expectations, gold will pick up a bit and gold stocks tend to do the same. Should we see an inflationary concern reemerge? I mean, do you think we've turned a corner? Do you see price action in those spaces that would indicate maybe 2015 was the low and we're kind of in the clear? What are your thoughts?
I do. I think we have turned the corner in the gold market. I think calls for 1,700, as you hear from various people that are out there, I think are a little overblown at this point in time. Inflation is on the move. And I would say, I think one of the major contributors to the inflation stats that we've seen, 0.6% rise in the PPI, 0.6% rise in the CPI, which is, I think, equates to somewhere around 7.2% annualized. Big numbers for January. What's contributing that, I think, is the significant rise that we've seen at the short end of the curve as well. Not maybe the six-month paper or the one-year paper, but the two-year paper, Treasury note, has risen about 60 basis points. This significantly increases the operational costs of many companies that are out there, particularly manufacturers. So yes, inflation's on the move, perhaps not in the way that we'd like, because we normally call it a demand pull inflation. I think this is more of a cost push. Demand being that consumerism is picking up, as you have spoken of before on this show. But I don't think that's the case. I think with the results that we've seen in retail sales being somewhat mediocre, with the benefactors being kind of random, Amazon doing well, Walmart not doing so well, we're not exactly turning the corner in terms of demand pull. What we're really turning the corner in is it goes back to, again, this overabundance of debt with no buyers. We've got rates that are moving up because the bond prices are moving down. So yes, I do see opportunities in the gold stocks. They're poised for a turnaround. As you know, in the last 5-6 years, they've been tightening their belts, lowering their costs. This primes them for a very strong move to the upside as gold starts to accelerate.
Yeah, a month or so ago, I was highlighting the difference between what we need to be supplying the market and kind of keep stasis. About 90 million ounces a year is what we need to be in finding and discoveries and bringing to market. And we're in the 10 to 15 million range. So kind of interestingly, if we are seeing a turn in the price, and that's an indication of increasing demand, we're going to experience a little bit of a supply crunch because of underinvestment in new exploration projects over the last 5-6 years as companies have had to tighten their belts, cut exploration budgets, et cetera. So Doug, on a different subject, you know, you've worked with small firms, you've worked with very large firms. What do you hope to accomplish with our firm and the rollout of the tactical short at the beginning of Q2 here in early April, just around the corner?
Sure. And David, you're a wonderful person and you lead a wonderful group of folks here. So I'm honored to be part of it. I guess I'm at the stage of my career where I'll only work with people I admire and trust and that I'd go to battle with. And I found that here as far as our product. I've also come to believe that if you're going to run an alternative investment strategy, you really can't do it at a big firm. It just doesn't work. The big firms, they don't nurture independent thinking like the small firms. So we're going to use our independent thinking and our unconventional contrarian analysis and put together our new product. And what are we trying to accomplish? I just want to put together a tactical short product that makes sense to investors. And then I want to make sure it's successful. And I want to build something that's around 20 years from now. And it's all about a strategy, a philosophy, and executing a challenging strategy, but executing it every day and trying to create value for our investors in what will be, I think, an unstable environment.
Well, tell us about a conference call coming up here at the end of March.
Yeah, that'll be an opportunity for us to give some more details. I'll certainly delve into, you know, the investment philosophy we have, get somewhat granular into our investment process that I think is very important. And we'll talk a little bit about the global environment, the U.S. environment, I think I'll try to make a case that 2017 is an inflection year, that it's time to refocus on risk after really not having to worry much about it for 8-9 years. And then we'll take a lot of questions. Hopefully we'll get some good questions. I think we're going to set it up where folks can email in questions and I'll go down the list and try to answer them.
Well, gentlemen, I'm grateful you're both on the team. 2017 promises to be a fascinating chapter in investment history, and I'm glad we're working shoulder to shoulder together on behalf of our clients. Thanks for joining the conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate being invited.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. If you would like to read Dave Burgess's weekly recap, go to mwealthm.com. Or if you'd also like to read Doug Nolan's Credit Bubble Bulletin Weekly, you can read that for free also at mwealthm.com. Thanks for listening.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.